all is don't become a target, which puts researchers in a very and not just researchers, foundations and institutes, research institutes, think tanks, in a very difficult position where we're being told, just stay low, don't mention too much the research you're doing so you don't become a target. Well, sometimes the main way we present our research is on a website. And all at universities all over the country, websites are being taken down or they're being relabeled. You don't put race or anti-racism in your website, title, because that might make you a target. And so there are, I have a little tiny program. The ones that we should really, really be concerned about are these big multi-million dollar projects that are looking into the impact of health inequities and other kinds of structural inequities, economic inequities, housing inequities, inequities in incarceration, all these inequities that still require research, but again, I want to stress even more require affirmative practices and programs and policies to end them. All of that is now under assault. And, in my opinion, we've been making too little progress. And to now see what progress we've made set back, and again, not only set back, but the idea that that progress toward greater inclusion and greater equity is seen as anti-American, is seen as harmful. What it I think it's we can't even fathom. We won't know the extent of the damage of that. What's the damage to children who are not learning about the actual history, the truth about US history, the truth about the reasons for inequities?
With Linda McMahon, the former head of the World Wrestling Federation, now the head of the Department of Education.
And seeking to end it altogether, this department, to give so that states, including right-wing red states, can take over the curriculum. And it's already happening. The Supreme Court just said it was all right for parents to object to, woke topics. What's that going to mean? It's probably going to mean that school districts are just going to eliminate certain topics because you can't manage parents taking their children out of classes that they say represent wokeness.
I mean, Black American history is, I mean, it's back when I was in high school in Eastchester, New York, in the 1960s, they didn't teach Black American history. But since then, this is one of the great achievements of American society that Black, you could go to a high school now and take Black American history, certainly in a university. But this is woke. This is now being targeted.
Well, and even more so, it is American history. You cannot eliminate Black people from American history. You cannot eliminate the not only slavery, but it may, just as importantly, the resistance that Black people historically have made against inequality, the civil rights movement, all the freedom struggles that Black people have led in America that you can't understand America today, the freedoms that we have.
Well, the entire American economy, the history of the foundations of the American economy are Black chattel slavery and immigrants.
So how can you cannot teach US history if you eliminate all of this. So what is it that children in these red states are going to be learning, or even the way in which blue states are, some of them are capitulating to the administration because of the threats that they're under, that they're going to lose all their federal funding if they don't bow down to this false curriculum.
Now, have you read this? Have you read this? I hate to say it, big, beautiful bill, right? And it always makes me laugh. I don't know if I would laugh or scream when I hear journalists at the White House press briefing, you know, the pack of journalists asking about the big beautiful bill. Caroline, can we ask you about the big beautiful bill? And I think, like, what a bunch of sheep. I call it the bailout for big billionaires bill, but it's the big beautiful, like, it's a thousand. Have you scanned it? Do you know in what ways it's cutting back on health, wellness, nutrition?
I haven't. Yes, exactly. Exactly. I haven't read it, you know, through and through. I've read a number of very detailed summaries, including one at the New York Times that showed what is going to increase the deficit and what is going to lower the deficit. And of course, what's lowering the deficit are the cuts to the programs that people need, in some cases, literally to survive. And what's increasing the deficit are all the tax cuts to wealthy people and increases in immigration enforcement and deportations and other kinds of brutal policy. So it's very stark what this law is, what the impact is of this law. It's all about slashing care for people who need it for human needs and increasing funding for the most brutal, unjust policies.
I mean, programs like, for example, that provide breakfasts to kids in inner city schools or in marginalized districts.
Yeah.
Or that provide for teacher training.
Yes. Or health care for disabled elderly people. What is going to happen to people who are being cared for by relatives and supported by current funding? They were already slashing. I remember reading a little story about how the office that was providing heat, you know, supplements and cool air supplements to people was just shut down. And what happens to people who are relying on these programs to stay cool in this heat wave, and then in the winter to stay warm? We already know that people die in these conditions already. So now when you cut the supplemental help that existed, which is already too stingy, what's going to happen? It's all we can do is speculate, but it's likely going to lead to deaths of who knows how many people, as well as the intensified struggles of families, entire families, and the devastating trauma. The trauma is too light a word, but devastating trauma to families that are torn apart by deportations. And there hasn't been much examination of the system I call a family policing system, what many people call child welfare, child protection, which was the subject of my latest book, Torn Apart. That is a system that doesn't get the attention it should. Now, this is a system where people accused of child maltreatment, which is usually means they simply don't have the means to take care of their children, are now investigated, and often their children are taken from them and put in a very damaging foster system. All of this is going to lead to more children being placed in the foster system, because families are going to be struggling even more. If you have a family that was relying on breakfast at school to give their children breakfast, and now their children come to school hungry without breakfast, there are teachers who will feel that they're mandated to report the family to Child Protective Services. And there are caseworkers that will then investigate. And if they don't see breakfast cereal or milk or eggs in the refrigerator, if they open the refrigerator door and it's empty, they look in pantries and it's empty, they may very well immediately remove those children from their homes and put them in the foster system. This happens already by the tens of thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of children are taken every year. Again, most of them impoverished or low-income families that simply don't have the means to provide for their children. And if the meager means that they've had to survive are stripped from them, we're going to see an increase in what I think is better called family policing and family separation. So it's not only family separation in the context of deportation. It's also family separation in the context of the so-called child welfare system.
Internal deportees.
Yes, internal deportees. I work with an organization called JMAC for Children that had put up a poster in Harlem that said children are separated at the border of Harlem too. It's not just the Mexican border, the southern border, but the borders of Black segregated impoverished neighborhoods where children are being taken at astronomical rates, as well as on Native communities, tribal communities in the United States. Still, Black children, Indigenous or Native children, are removed at high rates, and their parental rights terminated as well. Their legal relationships to their families terminated because of the struggles that their families are going through.
Dorothy Roberts, I want to ask you to tell me briefly about your brand new book, The Mixed Marriage Project, which sounds very interesting. I need to get a copy. But let me ask you, I mean, the answer should be obvious. I'm wondering, you know, are you worried? Are you worried? But on the upside, do you feel that America is a more equitable and just place than it was when you were growing up?
Oh, you ask me these questions where I have two thoughts going, because I grew up in Chicago in a very diverse community, Hyde Park Kenwood, on the south side of Chicago. My parents were a mixed couple. My mother's Black, my father's white, and they believed very strongly that interracial relationships could thrive in America and could bring people together. I do not agree with their philosophy that that's the answer to racism in America. I think when we end racism in America, we will be freer to engage in interracial relationships. But I grew up in a household that was very hopeful about the possibility of people loving each other across racial lines. And at a time in the 1960s, where there were mass protests going on across the country, civil rights protests and protests against the Vietnam War. In my elementary school, we had assemblies where we heard from civil rights leaders telling us that we had an obligation to fight against social injustice. I went to a church around the corner where we supported the freedom rides to the South. We filled envelopes, you know, trying to get support. We had a mass walkout from public schools to support desegregation of public schools. And we had an alternative school in the church. So this is the neighborhood I grew up in. I was taught as a child in school. And the idea that we wouldn't be taught about slavery, we wouldn't be taught about social justice, that was unthinkable. It was unthinkable that you would be in elementary school an apathetic child. You know, this was part of the ethos of my elementary school, to be an advocate for social justice. So to me, the idea now that that would be considered wrong, that you might lose your funding for that, that there would be a school district that would punish teachers who taught that, that the assemblies would be shut down. You know, that is unthinkable to me. So in a way, my first reaction is, we're worse off now. It's worse now. But on the other hand, we should not forget the victories that the abolitionist movement against slavery accomplished. You know, it is a momentous accomplishment that slavery was abolished. Let's not forget that. Yes, there are afterlives of slavery. We need to recognize that. But we shouldn't forget that there was a movement that succeeded in ending an institution that was grounded in the very foundations of U.S. society, that was protected by the U.S. Constitution, that for centuries people thought they couldn't even imagine America without slavery. They couldn't imagine that the nation, the economy could function without slavery. They couldn't imagine an idea about Black and white people that didn't see them in opposition, that didn't see Black people as enslavable and white people as natural born enslavers.
So where is America today?
Well, okay, let me just point out that we all, you know, yes, there was a backlash against that. And then there was a civil rights movement that ended official Jim Crow, official policy segregating the races. Okay, so we today are beneficiaries of those struggles, and we should recognize that. We should celebrate that, and it should give us hope that we can have a movement that resists where we are today, because where we are today is absolutely a setback, another backlash, like the backlash against Reconstruction at the turn of the 20th century. I think we're in a period like that. It's important to recognize that despite that backlash against emancipation and Reconstruction, there emerged a civil rights movement, a civil rights struggle, a freedom struggle that was successful in many respects. Not totally successful, but it was successful in ending official Jim Crow policies. And now we are seeing a move to reinstate those Jim Crow policies in another form. I think we need to recognize the existential danger of that, but we also need to remember that people's movements have been able to resist those existential disastrous policies in the past and come out with a better America. Again, I'm not being Pollyannish or naive to think that America is on this advance, you know, toward freedom and equality without setbacks. And we're seeing a setback now. But I also, again, think we need to look at the history of resistance movements and the way that they emerge with ways of thinking and policies and struggles that are even more radical than in the past.
And you look at a guy like Mamdani running for mayor in New York City, and it's very exciting because you realize. If it happens in New York, it could happen in L.A., it could happen in Houston, yeah. It could happen in Detroit, Chicago, yeah. Or in some small town USA.
It could happen in red states when they realize what they were promised is not happening and they're losing their jobs and they're being flooded. Their relatives are dying from climate disasters. Their that maybe they'll finally wake up and see that all the programs that they think are horrible, like Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, actually sustain their lives, and we may see changes there as well.
Dorothy Roberts, last question. Can you very briefly tell us about the Mixed Marriage Project, a memoir of love, race, and family, and give us a brief pitch in maybe 3 minutes.
So this is my memoir, my first and only memoir, about my childhood growing up in Chicago in the 1960s in an interracial family, a white father, a black mother. And it is inspired by my discovery of my father's interviews of more than 500 black-white couples in Chicago, beginning in 1937, when he was a 21-year-old graduate student, and lasting all the way into the 1980s. So these are centuries worth of stories that he was told by black-white couples in Chicago. He never wrote the book. My whole childhood was influenced by his writing this book about mixed race couples. He never wrote it. And I, at one point, wanted to write the book. He never wrote. But as I was reading the interviews, which eventually my mother also conducted, I felt that their story was so fascinating. The question of how did my father, growing up in a segregated white neighborhood, in the early 1900s, he was born in 1905. How did he get so interested in interracial intimacy? He started dating black women long before he met my mother. And I find out that my father was this fascinating man who became interested in racial caste in America. That's what he called it. From when he was in high school, and ended up devoting a career to this idea that interracial intimacy could change America and end the racial caste system in America. So it is, I think, a fascinating, riveting book that combines the history of interracial relationships in Chicago with my personal journey, looking at my parents' marriage, but also my own identity, as a Black woman with a white father. I've always identified as Black, but there was a period of my life where I thought I had to hide the fact I had a white father to identify as Black. And so it's a reconciliation with my white father as well. Unfortunately, he passed away before I could really share these thoughts with him, but he left me this treasure trove, this remarkable treasure trove of interviews with hundreds of black-white couples who crossed the color line in Chicago.
Were these audio recorded interviews?
No, there they are. At first, his notes of his questions and answers, and also his notes about his experiences, which are just fascinating. And then, as well as my mother's, when she began in the 1950s, she was a student of his and began joining him before they were married on these excursions into the Black Belt in Chicago. And then in the 1950s, he begins recording them. I don't have the audio of, at least I haven't found the audio of these recordings, but I have all the transcripts, hundreds and hundreds of transcripts of the interviews.
Wow. Dorothy Roberts, well, we're going to link to your book, The Mixed Marriage Project, at the Green Planet Monitor. Dorothy Roberts, thank you so much again for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for addressing this urgent. It's a harrowing topic, but it's urgent that we pay attention and do what we can to resist and to create this better society, more caring, humane society, equitable society that we want.
Inshallah.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Take good care.
Dorothy Roberts is the 14th Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor, the George A. Weiss University Professor of Law and Sociology, and the Raymond Pace and Sadie Tanner Mosel Alexander Professor of Civil Rights at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society, and a prolific writer. Among her works, Fatal Invention, How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century, Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty, and Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. Dorothy Roberts' latest book, The Mixed Marriage Project, A Memoir of Love, Race, and Family, will be available in February 2026. Watch our complete conversation with Dorothy Roberts at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Some swifts and frigate birds stay aloft for months at a time. Scientists know this because they attached sensors to the birds. What they hadn't been able to learn for certain was whether birds might be sleeping on the wing, and if they do, for how long. It was thought that one half of a bird's brain might sleep at a time, as happens with some birds when resting on the ground. A 2016 study provided some solid answers. Tiny devices attached to the heads of frigate birds tracked electroencephalograph patterns and, crucially, head movements. The results were fascinating. Frigate birds did sleep while aloft, most often one half of the brain at a time, as suspected, but they also fell into normal whole brain sleep and sometimes even deeper REM sleep. But this deepest sleep came in bursts of just a few seconds, during which time the bird's head dipped, but its flight pattern stayed steady. An in-flight power nap. So frigate birds do sleep on the wing, just not very much. On average, 42 minutes per day. When perched on land, they sleep 12 hours a day. What still has scientists puzzled is how they can get by with so little sleep when flying for months at a time. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You are listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hi, this is Betty Levitt, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hi, this is Adam Cullen, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
You are listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc on 90.1 FM or on the web at cjsf.ca.
Hi, this is Hillary Scott, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hey, you're listening. Should I say I'm Jan Orden?
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Tune in for Who Knows What Music I'll Bring to You at 6 a.m. on Wednesdays. You'll hear On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc right here on 90.1 FM, CJSF, Simon Fraser University Campus Radio.
You're listening to